The final investigator I chatted with in Orlando was Dr. Ghassan Abu Alfa, and he began our conversation by commenting on new clinical research in biliary cancer.
I think this has been the year of biliary because we've been looking for some standard of care. And I think the ABC02 study of Dr. Valley and colleagues from the UK at least suggested, and for others probably proved, that gemcitabine and cisplatin is a standard of care with an improvement in progression-free survival. So we understand now that we have a platform that we can work on and base further research on for biliary tumors. So I think this really was important news.
Can you talk a little bit more about that study in terms of, you know, how it was set up and what they actually saw?
Sure. If anything, the study was a continuation of a previous study called the ABC01 study, which was a small study randomizing patients to gemcitabine cisplatin versus gemcitabine alone. And they decided, based on positive data that showed that improvement in survival, expanded to what's called the ABC02 study, and that included about 400 patients in total. And one of the critiques was that you're joining two studies into one and benefiting from the data of the phase two randomized per se. Nonetheless, understanding that this disease is rare would have been justifiable altogether. There was an improvement in overall survival that it measured an absolute of about 2+ months between the gemcis and the gem, and it clearly did not contribute any further side effects to the ones that we know about platinum plus gemcitabine. And obviously brought up some kind of platform, but of course stirred some debate as well in regard to if this really should be recognized as a standard of care per se or not.
What are some of the other research questions out there in biliary cancer?
One of the key questions that is pretty academic at this point is, and of course it pertains to that study or to others, is this one disease being intrahepatic cholangio, extrahepatic biliary tumors, gallbladder cancer, or are we dealing with three different diseases? And there's plenty of data out there that might tell you that the behavior of those tumors is quite different. We know very well from the surgical data, for example, that the recurrence pattern for gallbladder would differ from the one of cholangiocarcinoma, where gallbladder might recur rather in the local area where cholangiocarcinoma might spread as a metastatic disease. And obviously, this has underneath it a whole panel of biologic pathways that would explain the behaviors to be differently. I think we've been including together or lumping them together simply out of necessity, but this is something that the researchers are currently busy with, is should we consider future clinical trials at least separating the intrahepatic cholangio from the other biliary tumors, or should we continue to lump them together? So this is on the practical side. In addition to that, the key question is, are we using the gemcitabine cisplatin as a platform, and are we using this to add on biologic therapies to, or shall we consider other biologics still as a justified first-line therapy? And many pathways have been tested in gallbladder. Unfortunately, it has not been as lucky, I would say, as hepatoma to compare, simply because the expression, for example, of EGFRs is not really that well established or probably not that highly expressed. And as such, it really becomes a debate is which new targeted therapy shall we add to that platform, or which target therapy should be used as a single agent. For example, at the moment, we ourselves are busy with gemcitabine cisplatin plus sorafenib as being a platform for adding the anti-RAF / anti-angiogenic therapy, simply knowing that these could be vascularly as well understood. And there is some synergy that is quoted in the literature, preclinically at least, between platinum and anti-angiogenic being sorafenib. But there's plenty out there that people are enthusiastic about to test in biliary tumors, and I think this is a tumor that deserves lot of attention. Again, it might not necessarily affect us in the U.S. immediately, knowing that the numbers are low, but this is a global problem, and we hope to see some kind of well-established standards for it.
You mentioned sorafenib. Do we have any data on that in biliary cancers?
There is a very limited data, which unfortunately did not really stand to what we wished for. It's actually a single-agent study done by Dr. Anthony Alkuweri from California that at least is good that it was studied single-agent, and this is something that we always preach for, is that it will be always wise to study drugs as single agents because we really need to know the effect of the drug. However, it really didn't contribute much in regard to outcome, and as such, wouldn't justify to continue with that approach at the moment for sorafenib.
How about HCC? Anything's happened in the last year that is important for docs to know about?
A lot is going on in HCC. If anything, you know, since sorafenib has been established as a standard of care, the attempt, of course, on the metastatic disease setting is to try to see if anything could be added on to sorafenib or even if other combinations could be valuable other than sorafenib. And there are many trials at the moment ongoing. To name few, there are major phase 3 trials that either are about to open or opened already. One of them actually is important not only because of the prior data that it emanated from. It's about doxorubicin plus sorafenib versus sorafenib, which actually is based on the randomized phase 2 study that I had the privilege to lead evaluating doxorubicin plus sorafenib versus doxorubicin plus placebo, and that showed a major improvement in outcome being in TTP, PFS, and overall survival. This study is important because it's going to answer a question about adding an anthracycline to a antiangiogenic, and there is a science behind it. Actually, we know that anthracyclines depend on a molecule called ASK1, and we know now that RAF, which is another target for sorafenib, likes to bind with ASK1, and they go together and sit in the mitochondria, and as such, there's an argument that probably when ASK1 is not available to enhance the apoptotic activity of anthracyclines, if we give sorafenib and try to release or deactivate the RAF, and as such ASK1 become more available again for the doxorubicin to act upon, it might produce that synergy that we're hoping to see.
Are there situations where you think it's reasonable to use that combination outside a protocol setting?
I personally don't advise it very much as we all are eager sometimes when patients would need a certain choice of therapy. I still would recommend sorafenib as being the first-line treatment. However, at least anecdotally, we have seen cases where if patients would fail sorafenib adding the doxorubicin, it might re-emerge effect. And the question is it truly because of that combination effect that I just mentioned on the biological level?
What are some of the issues in giving doxorubicin to a patient with liver disease?
Doxorubicin clearly is affected and its metabolism is affected by the liver, and as such, liver function will be critical. And as we know, always using doxorubicin is guided by the level of bilirubin. And clearly, whenever you have a bilirubin more than 1.5 times normal, you probably will require no more than half of the dose of doxorubicin, being in our case 60 milligrams per meter square, it will become 30 milligrams per meter square. Nonetheless, in the HCC specific, I would say this doesn't pertain only to doxorubicin because as we know now, there's plenty of data about the concerns in more advanced cirrhotic situations and sorafenib per se. And as such, it's actually a pertinent concern, as you just mentioned, not only for the dox, but for the dox and sorafenib.
Anything else that's come out, any new research data in HCC you would like to talk about?
Definitely some other very valuable studies include the erlotinib plus bevacizumab study that has shown an improvement in outcome as well. This is currently the subject of a randomized phase 2 study of erlotinib bevacizumab versus sorafenib. I would like to take the opportunity to mention this is the kind of case studies that we would like to see where evidence-based phase 2 studies show a certain mark and then you try to do a randomized phase 2 to establish if really this is valuable before you expand it to phase 3. On the other hand, the sunitinib data that came out of two phase 2s is now the subject of a randomized phase 3 study, which is putting it head-to-head with sorafenib and looking for superiority. We have a little bit of concern about that study, which is really mobilizing or need to mobilize 1,200 patients based on the cancer.gov website to be able to answer that question, which truly is not based on no more than two clinical trials in a phase 2 setting and with limited number of patients, and add to this not showing more than the 9 to 10 month median survival that already we are aware of as being a historical control with sorafenib. There is also the adjuvant approach, which is being evaluated by a randomized study of adjuvant sorafenib versus placebo after surgery. There is the combination with local therapy, being like transarterial chemoembolization. There is a bridge to transplant. And again, as you can see, this is a multifaceted and multidisciplinary disease where applications for biologic therapies will be not limited only to metastatic nature.
I want to go through a bunch of the things that you just talked about in a little bit more depth. First, you mentioned erlotinib bevacizumab. Can you go through the data that we have right now in that combination?
Of course. So this was a limited phase 2 study published by Dr. Melanie Thomas when she was at MD Anderson. And the study has shown that the median survival will probably be reached somewhere in the 14 to 16 months. There was some revision to the data. That's why I give that branch. And in addition to that, it has shown that the progression-free survival will reach close to where the median survival of the sorafenib is, in other words, something in the 9 to 10 months. One critique to the data, to be objective in assessing it, that these patients were rather well-to-do in regard to their medical performance. There was a learning curve, and patients were scoped to rule out varices before they get on the study. And despite the fact that they were noted or coded as being CLIP3, we know very well that the CLIP3, which is one of the way we stage liver cancer, might not necessarily imply that patients are quite ill, even though it's relatively advanced. Nonetheless, all this data together, based on what we've been hearing for quite a bit about how you put in an active anti-angiogenic agent with an inactive anti-EGFR, might be very valuable, the same way we have seen the synergy from the lab all the way to the clinic. So I think it's a very valuable combination, and it will be nice to see what this tool show.
Again, any role you can see for that combination outside a protocol setting?
I personally, again, always being from the academic setting, I would not vouch or support the use of therapies that are not established out of clinical trial, but I can totally, on the practical level, understand the necessity and the needs. If anything, in my mind, as a lot of second-line trials are opening, this should be where patients should go after sorafenib. Nonetheless, in the case we can't, for either eligibility or inavailability, having a phase two that does support the combination, and if patients really are considered by their doctors to tolerate that therapy, one can make the case.
What do we know about bevacizumab and HCC?
Bevacizumab actually is one of the antiangiogenics that has been studied extensively in HCC. Actually, it started with single agent two studies that reported, again, similar disease control to the one we're talking about in regard to sorafenib, no true responses, but more stability of disease. And add to this also, it has shown a median survival in the 9 to 10 month range that we're talking about.
This is bevacizumab alone?
Bevacizumab alone. However, it came at a cost. There were a lot of bleedings. We know this is to be a very potent antiangiogenic, and as such, it kind of, you know, curbed the experience from that aspect. After that, there was combination with chemotherapies, among them gemcitabine and oxaliplatin, gemcitabine and capecitabine, and obviously the one that we just spoke about, which probably is the one that's quoted the most and has shown the best effect, is the bevacizumab plus erlotinib.
Anything that's come out in terms specifically of sorafenib in the last year?
Plenty is going on with sorafenib, and I'll try to dissect it as follows based on the stage of disease. In regard to metastatic disease, the data which just spoke about, the doc sorafenib phase 2 data. Number 2 is the subgroup analysis that has been showing up in regard, for example, to etiology, where hepatitis C patients have shown an improvement in outcome of 14 months here in regard to survival compared to 10.7 for the general population of the SHARP trial. This definitely speaks a lot about if the etiology per se has any impact on the effect of sorafenib or the benefit from sorafenib. And this might be an important academic aspect, at least for now. In the future studies, are we really dealing with HCC as one disease, or is it four diseases in one based on the different etiologies? The other one is the issue of management of patients with more advanced cirrhosis. There's data that we ourselves brought up part of the phase 2 study showing a concern in regard to the CHARSPUB patients not tolerating the therapy as much. A Japanese study kind of brought at least some concern, but at the same time some support for the use of the drug in that regard. And the third study that came out from the CLGB group that I was part of as well, that evaluated sorafenib in patients with organ dysfunction, and has shown that patients with a bilirubin more than 1.5 up to 3 will require to use half the dose of the drug, and above 3 you might not find a safe dose for those patients. Add to this, the erlotinib plus sorafenib data is mostly a phase 1 data, but nonetheless, it appealed to the sponsors and as well to some investigators, and especially that it kind of was understood as being a simile to the bevacizumab erlotinib exercise that I just mentioned, and as such, it's now the subject of a randomized phase 3 trial of sorafenib plus erlotinib versus sorafenib. This, in general, will talk about the metastatic disease setting. In regard to the locally advanced disease, there is a lot of interest in how you join or combine TACE plus antiangiogenic, and specifically most of the studies have been on sorafenib simply because it's the one that's available and it's the one that has been approved. I believe in the meeting there will be some data in this regard, which is to be published tomorrow. Nonetheless, other than that, there are two studies that will be evaluating this approach further. One of them is actually, again, part of the task force that I just mentioned. It's the hepatobiliary task Task Force and an ECOG study, the Eastern Cooperative Oncology Group, evaluating the use of sorafenib through the TACE and continuing after the TACE with it versus, of course, a placebo control. There is another international study with almost a similar design called the SPACE study. Very important here to go back a little bit preclinical because, of course, always those studies should not be always exciting from the idea of like a building block of sorafenib plus, but rather there is clearly some biology here behind it where we know very well, and this has been quoted in experiments in the preclinical setting, when you have a tumor that is to be embolized, let's assume on the right side of the liver, and if there is another tumor on the left side of the liver, in other words, in the right lobe and the left lobe tumor will probably, after the right one has been embolized, might grow. This is simply because of the angiogenic drive that was caused by killing that tumor on the right, and it's in response to it because tumors, of course, as we know, want to survive. So the theory that's brought up behind that subject is, would it really be valuable to have an anti-angiogenic drug to help cut or kill that surge of VEGF and angiogenesis that would occur after such treatment? And I think this is what Judah Folkman have been telling us all about for a while. I think it will be fascinating, these studies, what they will make. I personally put a lot of interest in the one from ECOG because the idea that the sorafenib is going through and through is very valuable, especially that we know that this angiogenic drive happens within 24 hours or less of the embolization itself.
What about safety and tolerability of the simultaneous TACE and sorafenib?
I thank you very much for asking this question. And this is an appeal and an urge. This is not to be really used out of the setting of clinical trials because the data is limited. As we said, there will be some data coming out of this meeting. So, of course, we're eager to see it. But add to this, I will be very careful and concerned because our safety understanding in this combination is really limited at this point. Maybe we are gaining comfort, but comfort is not necessarily proven data. So I definitely echo your point here.
Any questions that you get about TACE or any issues about how it is utilized or should be utilized?
The questions, it depends where they're coming from, are many. One of them is a little bit philosophical at this point, I would say. We know TACE is understood as a safe modality, but with a great debate that actually even at the FDA level is continued and it's not approved from that regard because, as we know, two trials have shown that it has an improvement in survival, but about seven studies at least did not show that improvement in survival. And I truly lay it out in a very objective way, not necessarily supporting or not supporting it, but rather saying that it's a big philosophical debate that continues to go on. Nonetheless, I think it established its role. It has a validity. And if anything, the question that comes to mind are, number one is, who are the eligible patients for TACE? And I think this is a little bit fluid on both sides of the curve or of the, if you want to call it, the roadmap of patients with HCC, because patients who have what's called locally advanced disease might be still pertinent for a surgical approach. On the other hand, patients with more advanced disease, including portal vein thrombosis, might be also considered for a systemic approach. And of course, the comfort zone for every interventional radiologist differs in regard to where do you declare the boundary for the TACE activity. The other one is coming along, other than the TACE plus sorafenib in the local disease, one argument that I'm a little bit concerned about is the one of using TACE as a modality to control the disease locally, followed by sorafenib to control the disease that is metastatic. And in other words, the use of TACE in the metastatic setting. That's pretty concerning. This needs a clinical trial. I would say it is a valid question, but short of having that clinical trial done, we cannot support the use of TACE in the metastatic setting as a modality to control the liver because the argument is this is where the disease might hurt and then continue with sorafenib to support the disease wherever it might be else, like the lung or the bone or what have we. And the reason is, again, I go back to the same example that we just mentioned about angiogenic drives. And what if we are causing a negative impact to the disease as a whole by trying to address it in one area rather than address it altogether? But these at least are some of the questions that come up.
What are the clinical situations that you think are most relevant in terms of using TACE? What's a classic situation where TACE would be used?
No question that a patient who has disease that's not amenable to surgery or to transplant but still localized to the liver will probably be a candidate for TACE. And when I say TACE, by the way, to clarify, we're not necessarily saying transarterial chemoembolization, but we use this as a default for transarterial chemoembolization or transarterial embolization as a bland embolization without chemotherapy. And because truly there are two schools of thoughts in regard to supporting one or the other. On the other hand, whenever the portal vein is involved, not necessarily necessarily the main one, but at least a branch of it, there is reasonable support from a lot of experts in the field that would say a taste will still be valid in that setting as well.
What about microspheres?
I would use the example of yttrium 90, and this definitely has gained a lot of momentum. There's plenty of data coming out. I think the expert on it is Dr. Riyad Salem from Northwestern. And the indication at the moment, as we understood it, is yttrium 90 for patients with localized disease plus portal vein thrombosis. And as such, giving a little bit of a opportunity for those patients that might not necessarily be eligible for TACE if they have quite much of thrombosis. Nonetheless, its use is expanding, and people have a certain and different comfort level with it. And again, this needs to be done in the hands of experts. The side effects from it with the radioactive material on board could be concerning. And obviously, it should be used within the indication as we just mentioned it.
What about the issue of the patient who's having a resection or transplant? Can you talk about, first of all, how you estimate the chance of cure? And what about the role of adjuvant therapy, specifically sorafenib?
Sure. It's very important to note, as much as there is always a lot of momentous discussion about transplant and surgery, that this applies, unfortunately, only to a very limited number of patients, simply because the disease, in many cases, is not caught in the early stage. Number two is, of those who would probably be subject to a resection or to transplant, there is a reasonable chance that they will recur. I think in the transplant, to at least address this one first, the Mazzaferro paper that came back in the 90s really was an important platform in regard to whom to transplant. And if anything, I don't go in the details of the Mazzaferro criteria, because in all fairness, there's a lot of debate if you want to expand those criteria or shrink them. But limited disease, this is the bottom line, limited disease. In the Mazzaferro, for example, it is one lesion less than 5 centimeter or 3 lesion less than 3 centimeter, no vascular involvement and no metastatic disease. As you can see, this is very limited disease, because truly the aspect of transplant should be understood. We're transplanted to get a healthy liver with limited disease, so we prevent the recurrence. Now, this definitely secured the extremely high 5-year survival that Dr. Mazzaferro had. But obviously, there was always this kind of inherent need to expand the envelope. And now, as you know, we talk about the metro ticket, where as simulated by how the metro works in most of the European cities, the further your trip is, the more expensive your ticket is. And as such, the more number of nodules there is, and the larger the size of the nodules is, the metro ticket or the criteria will impact the chance of recurrence and the chance of survival. And it's a really fascinating example of when you sit in transplant conferences to see how the different groups would differ in opinion regard to where to draw the line for the best metro ticket, which is cheap enough where it causes less of a chance for the patient to recur, but also will take you the further distance in regard to how many nodules or how many lesions and the size of the lesions.
What is your own criteria?
We actually don't have a transplant service at Memorial, believe it or not. So we very much kind of work conjointly for that aspect of the disease with Mount Sinai. And we send the patient to Sinai, and pretty much Sinai will go by those criteria. The Mazzaferro, in other words. Even though, of course, it depends sometimes on case-to-case basis, and people will decide to expand the criteria or not. In regard to surgery, again, surgery is really a functional question where, in other words, if the liver is good, the reserve is good, you can cut through. Size is not necessarily the matter. It's a vascular invasion per se. There's a lot of debate that surgery is tackled from two other corners. One of them is RFA for very small lesions. Would radiofrequency ablation cause the same impact positively on the disease compared to surgery for small disease with the least invasiveness? And the other hand, also an attack from transplant, where even the liver, if it's good function, because as I said, transplant is mainly addressing the concern of somebody with charged PUC, for example, somebody with bad liver. But what if somebody with charged PUA and possibly resectable disease but fit in within the transplant criteria? Would you transplant that patient? And I have to admit, this is a major debate still ongoing in regard to the transplant value in those patients compared to surgical resection. And frankly, it depends whom you hear. Of course, coming from a group which is very strong in the surgical world, I might be biased towards saying that if it's resectable, you got to go for surgery if the liver allows it.
What about adjuvant therapy, either after resection or transplant?
Again, I start by cautioning that we don't have data yet. This is a subject of debate with a long history, not necessarily just came up after the sorafenib became established standard of care. Actually, sorafenib is being studied currently versus placebo in patients with surgically resected disease. It's called the STORM study. We're waiting for the results of that study. That study in the criteria, again, published, is requiring patients to have limited disease, so it might have some limitation or some difficulty interpreting it to patients with larger disease after resection when it comes to community practice. Nonetheless, for now, I would not recommend the use of sorafenib in the adjuvant setting until this data comes out. There are safety concerns over here. Remember that sorafenib, even though in rare occasions, can cause bleeding, and this could really be a deleterious effect for unjustified indication until proven otherwise. But to take a little bit historically and kind of make sure that our colleagues are aware, the question of adjuvant therapy has been addressed for long in HCC, and actually it will be worth quoting a couple of studies, especially the one from Hong Kong by Thomas Lung, when they used actually iodine-131 intrahepatically, and they showed actually that overall survival and disease-free survival increased tremendously by use of that therapy after surgery. And for a while, actually, we've been sending our patients to Hong Kong for that therapy, which sadly nobody was able to reproduce and still is not available in our country. And the other one, of course, the use of retinoids from Japan, which, if you recall, it was published in New England Journal of Medicine, didn't really meet the primary endpoint, but then later, after a further look at 8 years, it showed some impact on outcome, but of course, again, ran out of favor because of that delay in establishing the improved outcome. And as such, now it's really in the hands of the STORM study in sorafenib. We'll see if we're going to have an adjuvant treatment for HCC or not.
Do you want to comment on bridge therapy?
Bridge therapy is a very specific situation that applies only to transplant, and where truly because of, you know, to start just the other way around, the bottleneck in transplant is not the patient. The bottleneck in transplant is the availability of liver. And as such, patients got to wait for livers. And the fear is that if patients will drop off the list because they progress, because actually this has been quoted as the most important prognostic sign, that patient drop off the list and as such will not be eligible for transplant. So the question is, do you have anything therapy-wise that will stabilize the disease to keep them in the transplantable arena? And one of the commonest things used is actually embolization or even RFA. And again, there's data on both ways, which will try to kind of, you know, temper the disease, allowing it to get to transplant. On the other hand, there is some argument also about having large disease that you might treat with one of those local modalities, bring it to a size that allows it to be transplantable. Even though here I would caution, this is a very serious fallacy that in oncology we do not agree upon, because for us in rectal cancer, in any cancer, a 7-centimeter tumor is a 7-centimeter tumor. If you shrink it to 5, it was a 7-centimeter tumor. So that bridge to transplant has to be really interpreted a little bit in a careful manner. Nonetheless, there is clearly discussion about a bridge to transplant using some of those local modalities, even with use of sorafenib.
Why don't we talk about one of your cases? This first case, is this a patient you actually took care of?
Yes, actually, the cases are all patients that are from our clinics.
Let's talk a little bit about your first case. How did this man present?
So this is a middle-aged man who actually has hepatitis C. This is, unfortunately, a big problem that we have in the country at the moment, seeing more of the hep C-related hepatomas, what we call the silent epidemic. And unfortunately, he showed up with hep HCC with metastatic disease as first presentation. And this is something that doctors are going to commonly see. Actually, he had even bone metastases part of that presentation. And obviously, we gave him sorafenib, being the standard of care. And it was a challenge to manage him in regard to side effects. And this is really what mainly I thought will be valuable to discuss.
So what happened?
Clearly, he developed what we call the head-foot syndrome. And the head-foot syndrome in sorafenib use, which probably similar to some other therapies like, for example, capecitabine, even though some particularities here differ, grade 1 is some tingling sensation, grade 2, some redness on the tips of the fingers, and grade 3, a true peeling of the skin. And of course, our job is to prevent patients from coming to that stage. And I have to say there was a learning curve even for us, because we have seen it on clinical trial. Of course, clinical trial setting is always a much more controlled setting. setting, and as such, you have a little bit closer eye on patients. And then we kind of like realize that in the real world, it's happening more commonly than we are seeing it on the clinical trial. So what we did with this patient, actually, we helped with a program that already we established. We have portals where actually patients can contact us through email, and they can send attachments, they can discuss. And what we encourage patients to do, and this nice man, one of them, is to actually take pictures of their fingertips and toes and email it to us and have the nurses kind of, you know, have a continuum of how they are doing and prevent the worst from happening rather early in the game. Actually, we do examine the skin very carefully. If it's a little bit more complex, we send them to one of our dermatologists. We have a great dermatologist who works with us now, who actually is the one who described a lot of the flow charts of how to manage head foot syndrome. His name is Mario Lacouture.
Yeah, you guys stole him away from Northwestern, huh? I just heard he left Northwestern, you know?
Well, I'll tell you, the day he came to Memorial, I felt so good about it because definitely we can work a lot together on things, and already we are. Nonetheless, as I said, this patient is a dramatic example where a little bit of redness, we saw it on pictures right in between the visits, and we called the patient, said, stop the therapy, wait a little bit of time, and continue the dose. And this definitely made a major effect. In general, the recommendation to kind of give some clear message, very important to examine the skin. Any cracks? Any dry skin, any cankers, just make sure that some podiatrist or somebody take care of them. A creaming, I have to admit, on personal experience, doesn't really make a difference, but it might only be valuable in dry weather and simply just kind of cause that emollient to be present. For example, now in New York, it's pretty cold and it's dry weather, so it does make sense per se. If it's grade one and tingling only, I would say continue the drug without any change, but just kind of you do some of that supportive measures we're talking about. If it's a grade two and it's redness, you might reduce the dose and just move on. If it's grade three and or grade two moving to three, definitely stop the drug, wait a little bit of time, and dose reduce and see how it evolves. I can assure you, a good management will definitely find one happy dose for every patient. And remember that the drug has quite a large therapeutic index, and as such, really, we can find out a appropriate dose for each one of those patients.
What fraction of patients with HCC who receive sorafenib have zero dermatologic problems?
I would say that at the moment, in reality, about 50 to 70% will not have any concern in regard to head foot syndrome. And about 30 and sometimes even up to 50 in certain populations and might not apply to us. Actually, I heard from our Japanese colleagues that they see it in about half of the patient. There should be a chance for some head foot syndrome.
There's been an interest in the issue of correlation with side effects, particularly, quote, on-target side effects, whatever that is, and anti-tumor effects in oncology in general, you know, hypertension and BEV, rash and EGFR inhibitors. And I saw a paper recently trying to correlate, I think it was hand-foot, with benefit of sorafenib in HCC. What did you think about that and about that idea?
I would say that so far, there's no data on that. I mean, clearly, it was actually an idea that came to everybody's mind, even from day zero, knowing how erlotinib and the rashes. But I would say not necessarily we have this, you know, proven.
So what's this man's current situation in terms of his tumor?
So this is, again, the other challenge. You know, we kind of let him go through, and he settled on a dose of half, 400 milligram daily. You could challenge them again if you want. We did it, but it didn't work, so we kept him at 400 milligram daily. And he kept being evaluated by CAT scans, and his CAT scans were always triphasic CT scans because, as we know, these tumors will feed on the arterial blood, so it's very important to have an arterial phase to be able to visualize it better, and this will help the radiologist in this regard. And of course, the decision in regard to therapy, again, a very important educational point. Here's the tumor growing a little bit, patient's feeling well, but at the same time, you just wonder, is this growth a true progression or is it simply an effect of the drug? We've been leaning rather towards continuing the drug simply because there's no other choices, but at the same time, understanding that probably that mild growth is a effect of the tumor necrosis that we have seen on that patient. So arterial phase pictures are very critical. It's very important to educate the radiologist who's involved and explain that don't expect because of the therapy that we're giving that tumors will shrink, but probably we're going to see some difference in the consistency of the tumors. And as such, make a decision that's really based on how patients are doing, how their CAT scan look, and in addition, sometimes alpha-fetoprotein, even though this is not a validated marker.
So you're saying that you might actually see an increase. Is it like it's not really tumor progression?
Correct. I wouldn't necessarily say I would push the envelope to something that is definitely progression of disease, but some mild growth is totally justifiable and it's totally expected and there should be no concern about it. But obviously, it has to be put in the big picture of how the patient is doing. Is there any change in consistency of the tumor? Does it look necrotic? What's the alpha fetoprotein doing if it is of value in that specific patient? I hope, actually, we're working part of that randomized phase 3 trial I told you about of sorafenib plus doxorubicin versus sorafenib. We're doing a prospective analysis of tumor necrosis volume on every patient. And we might actually come to some standard of how to assess HCC after that exercise.